This is the Past Lives podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. My mission here at the Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. To get access to the extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives podcast Patreon campaign. And when you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My guest this week is Kathy Bird. At 2 years old, Kathy's son Christian started sharing memories of being a baseball player in the 1920s and 1930s. This set Kathy on an amazing journey to discover who Christian was in a previous life and to find out about her own previous life relationship with her son. During the conversation with Kathy, we discussed the case of James Leininger. And what I thought I'd do, for those of you who are not really aware of his case, is add a section on the end after the interview that will describe the James Leininger case so you can really get to grips with it. Also, Kathy mentions that she talked to Carol Bowman, and Carol Bowman was also a guest on the Past Lives podcast. And if you'd like to listen to Carol's interview, it is episode 18. Hi, Kathy. Well, thank you for coming on to the Past Lives podcast. It's great of you to give us your time.
Thank you, Simon, and thank you for doing what you do.
We'll be talking about your son, Christian, who has these amazing memories of a previous life. But first of all, could you tell us, did you have a religious upbringing?
You know what, my belief system, I was pretty much raised in a Christian family growing up, going to church. And that was a little bit of a problem when my son started saying these things, because it was really in conflict with what I had been raised to believe in, the concept of reincarnation.
Yes, from a modern Christian point of view, it's not allowed, is it?
Right, right.
But we did find what you said in your book, when Christianity started, it was more or less part of the viewpoint of Christianity, but then it was removed.
Right. What's amazing about that is the more that I researched the history of Christianity, and I learned that there were actual scriptures that were taken out of the Bible referring to reincarnation, it actually kind of eased my guilt. You know, I kind of felt like I was cheating on Jesus, is what I refer to it as in my book. But I did. I had a real guilt about even considering that my son was possibly a reincarnation, because it just was so out of alignment with my beliefs.
And so you've managed to incorporate that now into your beliefs?
Right. I mean, I've managed to just accept it and kind of to accept that none of us have all of the answers. You know, no priest, no pastor, no rabbi, no scientist, you know, nobody really knows until we die. So it just really helped to open my mind and accept it as a possibility.
So there is a phenomenon that's been reported quite widely of something called an announcing dream, where before the child is born, the mother would have a dream of the child saying, I'm going to come to you and be your son. Did you have anything like that happen?
Right. You know what? I've had friends who've had really vivid dreams like that. I did silly stuff, like I would buy blue blankets before I knew I was having a boy, and I started buying blue clothes. And I never even really wanted a son, because I had a daughter and I was in love with my daughter. And I thought, what would I ever do with a son? So I guess there is, on an intuitive level, as a mother, it's kind of there in your subconscious a bit, I think. Yeah, I've definitely had stories from friends that have had those announcing dreams, which is pretty remarkable.
Christian started talking about a previous life as a baseball player at a very early age. What was the first sort of things that he was saying?
Right. So he was very young. Like, he could barely walk when he first became very obsessed with baseball. And just to give you a background, we are not a baseball family. His father is German, and, you know, still I have to drag him to even go to Christian's baseball games, because it's just not in his upbringing, the baseball thing. So Christian discovered baseball from the neighborhood kids. and became totally obsessed with it. He wore a uniform every day, insisted on wearing little tiny cleats, you know, carrying this bat around with him. He wasn't speaking really until, you know, the age of like 2.5 is when he started to say things to us about it. You know, his obsession was very clear. And it's also important to note too, that at this point he had not watched television. He had not been exposed to any information on baseball. So when he first came out and started saying things that were historically accurate, it was just shocking to us, you know, like we were shocked because we knew what he had been exposed to. And some of the stuff we had to look it up ourselves to even find out that it was true.
And what sort of things did he say?
Started when he was like 2.5, and he started out saying things like, "Mommy, I used to be a tall baseball player." You know, and we would just kind of say, "Oh, yeah, someday you'll be a tall baseball player," you know, thinking he was dreaming of someday being a baseball player. And then over time, he got more and more specific, and he got more and more frustrated too. Like one day I was pitching balls to him in the house, and he just like stomped his foot and said, "Mommy, I was tall like Daddy," you know? And so I was like, "You mean you were a grown up?" And he finally had this huge look of relief. Like, "That's what I've been trying to tell you here for the last few months." So, and then when we went, he was cast in a role of a movie, that Adam Sandler was doing in Boston. And I believe that this is kind of where the floodgates opened up for him, because he had made comments prior to that trip. So he was 2 years old when he was discovered on YouTube by Adam Sandler for this baseball playing role. And we went back to Boston, and he made some comments, you know, while we were on our way there. And he made some comments when I took him to a baseball game at Fenway Park. He made some, you know, kind of startling comments. Like, he got very uncomfortable when he saw a picture of Babe Ruth, and he, you know, kind of had a fit and said, "I don't like him. He was mean to me." You know, we had to actually leave the stadium because he was so upset by this. And as a mother, it's a little bit, you know, eerie or disconcerting. And at this point, we didn't know what it was. But basically, when we came back from that trip is when he started saying things like, you know, I used to stay in hotels almost every night. And, you know, and I would ask him questions. I didn't really believe what he was saying, but I would say, "Oh, did you fly on airplanes?" And he said, "No, mostly trains." And then I would go Google it. The minute he fell asleep, I would go Google, say, you know, like, "Babe Ruth travel on trains." And sure enough, Babe Ruth traveled on trains. And, you know, if a child is 3 years old, there's no way in the world they're going to know that baseball players stay in hotels. So there were just things like that where we kind of went, "What is this?" And when he made the comments, it was very consistent with the behavior of children who recall past lives. I'd reached out to Carol Bowman initially, and she's the one who told me to ask him questions and kind of to do it when he was drowsy at night, but not lead him. She's the one that suggested I show him photographs of Babe Ruth's era once I told her all the things he had said. And sure enough, you know, he was able to identify and said, "This is me." And he pointed to a guy with dimples who turned out to be Lou Gehrig when I Googled it. And we just got more and more specific. So Carol coached me on finding pictures of Lou Gehrig's family and seeing if he could recognize the parents and identify their names. So I did that. And sure enough, he was able to identify their correct names. So it kind of just took us on this path. And it really started, I also went to my pastor initially. And my pastor kind of insinuated that he could be possessed by the spirit of a dead person, which is definitely not a path you want to go down when you have a three-year-old child. So that's really how I found these alternative explanations and these mentors who really helped me, like Carol Bowman and Dr. Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia.
And so there must have come a point where you had a realization that there really was something that pointed to genuine past life memories. And was this a sudden thing in one moment, or was it gradual? Was it a real shock?
It was a very gradual thing. And I have to be honest with you, even for the first couple of years, I mean, you question, you know, there's something different there. And he did have like very, very profound baseball skills. Like, even Tommy Lasorda, the Dodger manager, invited him to spring training to play with the Major League Baseball players when he was 4 years old. And he did a first pitch at Dodger Stadium when he was 3 years old. And the photograph from that pitch ended up on the walls. It's still there. When we go to Dodger Stadium, there's still a picture of him doing his first pitch. So there was that otherworldly kind of, like kind of beyond his years as far as his talent for baseball and his aptitude and his passion. But even then, you still question, you know, like you wake up every day and you're just living your life and you're going to Mommy and Me and you're doing your little things that you do. So you don't give it a lot of thought, but it was almost like peeling off the layers of an onion. Like as more and more things started to happen is when you say there's something to this. And really as a parent, you want to listen to your child and not dismiss it or not make them feel embarrassed about it. You know, and the people like you who are raising the awareness around it, you know, it really helped me to have resources.
Was he very emotional as well? I suppose he wasn't just stating facts. There must have been emotion around it.
Right, right. And it is, and I've talked to other parents. I have a lot of parents approach me too who are struggling. You know, it's a real struggle when your child starts expressing things like that. And there is emotion attached. There's also something that Carol and Jim both talk about and Ian Stevenson. It's not fantasy play. It's like very easy to tell when they're in this mode. And it's usually right before bed or right when they wake up. And it's almost like an adult-like tone too when they're saying these things. So it's not 24/7 that they're just sitting here and gabbing about, oh, I used to do this and I used to do that and I rode a unicorn. Like, you know, when kids are in fantasy play and this kind of thing, and there's a lot of emotion attached to it.
And was he more of a mature child than the other kids around him? Did he seem a wise old soul, so to speak?
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was definitely out of the norm in that way, you know, and he didn't even, you know, like I'd be in classes where kids are blowing bubbles and doing all these things. And he wanted to be there and have me pitch him balls. And he was just very obsessive and single-minded when it came to baseball. So some of it is like a bit antisocial behavior as a mother, too. Like it's even almost embarrassing when everyone's doing bubbles and your kid wants to play baseball. So, or even at school, you know, they would do circle time and the teacher had to actually do a little baseball carpet for him to sit with the group. And, you know, they would do art and everyone would draw an animal and Christian would draw a baseball. And, you know, so it was just part of who he was.
And that's what I got from the book, was that he was really obsessed with it. It was like every waking moment he wanted to be playing baseball.
Right, right. He's still like that. You know, we went this weekend, he had a workout with the USA national team. So he's now 10 years old and still playing baseball at a pretty high level and still has that same passion for it.
Well, that's fantastic, isn't it?
It's been a journey. I've learned a lot because I was not a baseball person. And now I spend many of my days each week at baseball.
Have you really got into it now? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've learned. Yeah. You would never guess that I didn't know about it before, because I probably know more than most people now.
Are you collecting the baseballs with the signatures on them?
Oh, yes. We've got lots of those. The best one we ever got was from a player for the Dodgers who wrote a very good book, a very spiritual book. And he wrote, you know, good luck, Christian. Can't wait to see you in the major leagues again. Sean Green. And it was from a guy who has set the same record that Lou Gehrig set, which was kind of neat. They both hit 4 home runs in one game.
So there was a talk in the book about the relationship between Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth and how that fell apart. And you were able to look back and find the history of that.
Right. And at first, when Christian had that upset with Babe Ruth, and it continued, like he, you know, his sister, when she would be upset with him, would say, you're Babe Ruth, you know, and it would really fire him up. Like he to him, you call him Babe Ruth, that was the worst thing you could call him when he was little. And so when you, at first glance, you see pictures of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig hugging and friendly, and they went on barnstorming trips together. But as he would tell me things, I mean, he told me really specific details around why he was mad at Babe Ruth. And I would research it, and I found through, you know, really researching it, that they did have a bit of a falling out. It had to do with Lou Gehrig's mother, and that was something that Christian had led me to. You know, he said that it was because Babe Ruth was mean to his mother. So it was just, you know, as he got older, his interpretation got more and more detailed. And then about the age of six and a half, the details started to dissipate. And in my book, I talk about it. It's almost as if he was trying to grasp. It's like when you wake up from a dream and it's there on your mind. And as you get up and brush your teeth, it's gone. So it was kind of like that. Like he would try to grasp it and it would just be elusive to him as he got older.
You also mention in the book that there's a kind of distinct way that Lou Gehrig used to hold his body when he was pitching or batting, and that Christian had this movement as well. And it was not the usual way that people would do it.
Right, right. It's interesting you remember that detail. Yeah, they definitely had a different batting stance and swing. And even now, Christian has a lot of those behaviors left over. So if you look at videos side by side, you can see the resemblance. And they're both left-handed, throwing and hitting. And they both have big dimples. So there's some similarities. If you put them side by side, you can definitely see it.
Was there any kind of physical carryover from Lou Gehrig? Since, you know, it's quite famous that there's Lou Gehrig's disease. And I believe Christian had asthma.
Right. He had some breathing problems that he has thankfully kind of outgrown. He hasn't had any issues with it lately. But he did. He had some breathing problems. And it was a little disconcerting to me when I did things like I ordered Lou Gehrig's death certificate, and the final cause of death was respiratory failure due to complications of infantile paralysis, which we now refer to as Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. But Christian, I really believe that through this work and through this healing, that also helped with his asthma, because he really kind of came to terms with it. And thankfully, he hasn't had that problem anymore.
Well, that's good. And these kind of physical things, like the way he plays and the problem he used to have with the breathing, these are kind of verify the truth of the reincarnation in a way.
Right. And it seems to be, you know, those are consistent markers. I haven't, you know, noticed any birthmarks or things like that. I know Ian Stevenson similarly had a health ailment like that too, that he attributed to past life. So they did look at things like that in the research at University of Virginia School of Medicine. That is one of the things they track when looking for carryovers from past lives.
And so can you tell us about the visit from Jim Tucker and how that happened?
Yeah, so I reached out to Jim. He had just published his book on children's past lives, and he had a lot of cases of American people. And one of the boys that we've become close with is James Leininger. And that story was very instrumental in kind of understanding where Christian was coming from, too. So I reached out to Jim and asked if he could come, you know, or we could go there. And he offered to come to California. He came to our home and he met Christian and he played a little baseball with him while he asked him questions. But what was most remarkable to me about that trip was Christian was playing baseball while Jim and I were talking, and Christian turned around. Jim was asking him questions at one point and said, you know, how did you die? Which was a question I had never asked him because I never kind of went there. And Christian said, my body stopped working. And then out of the blue, Christian said, I picked her to be my mom. And it opened up a whole new conversation. And we started asking questions. Jim asked, where was she when you picked her? And Christian said, she was being born. So he was saying he picked me as I was being born. And Jim asked, where were you? And he said, in the sky. And so what was surprising to me is then Jim said that a lot of these kids that recall past lives also recall choosing their parents. And that was something I was able to talk to James Leininger's mother about too. And we were in Hawaii at the Pink Hotel where James Leininger recalls choosing her parents. We were just there in December, and I reached out to Andrea, and she enjoyed that. She said, that's the place. That's where he saw us.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyze what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. Yeah, James Leininger's story is amazing, and Jim's did so much detail in his book to cover it. It really is a great case for reincarnation.
It really is. It really is.
Yeah, so when Christian said he chose you to be his mother, was that quite a shock? How did you feel?
Yeah, you know, even then, I was believing but not believing. I always had one foot out, and that was when Christian was five. And as you read my book, you'll see, like, the first half is really about, you know, him from the age of 2 to 5 up until when Jim Tucker visits and kind of all his memories. But what happened that day when Jim visited is it kind of opened my mind, like, to the possibility of something else that Christian had been telling me since he was very young. So ever since I showed him the photos of Lou Gehrig's mother, he said, "You were her." And I never really took that seriously at all. I really thought that was his way of assimilating past life with present life. He just kind of morphed me into her. But he was pretty persistent about it, you know, the fact that I was his mother when he was Lou Gehrig. So when he said this to Dr. Tucker, I asked Dr. Tucker while he was here, how he felt about past life regressions, because it was something I had never really considered doing, because to me, it seemed like it was like going to a psychic, you know, or something like that, like kind of out of bounds. So Dr. Tucker, they don't use past life regressions for their research, and they don't look at that as hardcore research for their purposes. But he was a little bit positive about it, and it was enough that like a week after he was here, I went and did a past life regression. And so the second half of the book, as you know, is this whole delving into the lives of Lou Gehrig and his mother. And the things that came out of that past life regression are really inexplicable. And the things that I saw, the things that I spoke about, things that were only verifiable through death certificates and, you know, had never been documented before, or through people who were still alive, who were people that I saw in the regressions. So for me, I would say that until the final moment in the book, when I, you know, meet these people that I had seen in my past life regressions and they're able to confirm what I saw, I would say I was still on the fence. Like, it really, that was for me the defining moment where I could say, okay, I accept this, and that's my proof. It was like I was on this endless quest for some kind of confirmation outside of myself and outside of Christian. Like, could this be real?
And how were the hypnotic regressions for you? Because you didn't just do the one, did you? You did others as well.
Right, right. I did it. Yeah, I went back again, and it was very surprising to Jerome DeWitt is the person I did it with. And it was very surprising to him, because each time I went back to the same lifetime. I went back to Christine. I ended up right back in her body at different points in her life, which was really surprising to him. So it was a really healing process for me as well. Those were hard chapters for me to write, though, because energetically, like, to go back into that space, it's kind of heavy. And even to write the book was a real stretch, because when these memories start to disappear, when your child gets older, it's almost like a relief. And I can see why a lot of parents don't even talk about it. You know, like, once it's over, and you want to get on and you want to live your life. And even, you know, it's similar. Wayne Dyer wrote a book, his last book before he passed, was Memories, about children's memories of, it's called Memories of Heaven. And he does a whole chapter on past life memories. He does a whole chapter on invisible friends, you know, seeing angels, visitations from angels and things like this. And one of the things I have to say is it's such a relief once it passes. Like, it's remarkable and magical, but it's not something you want to dwell on. You really want to take advantage of being in this lifetime, and you want your child to be in this lifetime.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And during the regressions, did other lives crop up, or did you only view the one life?
Yeah, I only viewed that one life. And I have gone back recently since then. I went back because the thing I really love about past life regressions too, anyone who uses the Dolores Cannon method, the quantum healing hypnosis technique, at the very end, they take you on this adventure kind of where you can ask questions of your higher self to get guidance. And I have to say the guidance that I've gotten in those moments has been so amazing. So I have gone back, and it was kind of a relief when I didn't go back to the Lou Gehrig lifetime. I went back to like a Native American lifetime, which was really special. And again, everything was totally historically accurate, which always shocks me every time. But I just found it to be a very just soul journey. I think it kind of unlocks a new door to your soul.
I've been through several past life regressions myself. I always love doing it because just being hypnotized is such a wonderful relaxation,
and
you can just go into yourself, and it's almost you get to the end of the past life regression and they're starting to bring you out of the hypnosis and you're feeling
right.
Oh no, don't stop, I feel really good.
It's almost like having your alarm go off on a Sunday morning when you're having a really good dream, like don't wake me up.
yeah,
because you're really out of your conscious mind, right? Like you're really in that subconscious mind.
So how many things came up during the regressions that were like facts that you could verify?
Well, the most amazing was, you know, I went through many different phases of their lives together, and a lot of it was recorded, you know, in history. I could find it in books or things like that. But the one thing that was really shocking is I found myself as an elderly woman. It turned out to be right around 1952, where I was living with a family, and I said, "Oh, there's a 10-year-old and maybe 13-year-old, like a 10-year-old girl and a 13-year-old boy." I went later and found out that she actually lived with this family, that the kids were the exact age, like the time of my regression, they were the exact ages that I said during my regression. And these are things I could have never, ever known. So to be able, and I described the floor plan of their house, they verified that's exactly how their house was set up. So it was just remarkable. I mean, things like I had a bird on a table next to me on the chair, and that's where she kept her bird, you know, like just beyond a little dog that lived with them. And yes, her dog lived with them. And when I finally was able to meet this man, who was 73 years old when I first met him, and he was able to share all these wonderful stories with me, it was almost like getting to know Lou Gehrig's mom, you know, like it's just been such a special relationship. And this person is a pastor, which is really interesting because that's the last person I wanted to talk to about reincarnation. So it's so ironic that he's a very prestigious, and he's done a lot of work internationally. He's a Methodist pastor. And so he doesn't believe in reincarnation, but the way that he put it, he said, "Kathy, what you've experienced here is something, it's information and knowledge that doesn't come from rational mind. It comes from a dimension beyond us." Basically, he felt that I was channeling information from Lou Gehrig's mother, and that my son was channeling information from Lou Gehrig so that those two souls could find healing while they're in heaven. And so I leave the interpretation open in the book, and now we're working on a movie of the book as well. And I really want people to make their own conclusions as to what it was. And then, like I said, none of us will know for sure until we die, right? Like we can put little bits of evidence together and come up with our own theories. But I just think it's a great exploration into the mystery of life.
Yeah, you're right. We'll never know until we get there.
Right. That's what I love. Wayne Dyer always uses the Mark Twain quote. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. So I never try to be too sure about things.
Did Christian have any memories of the intermission period between Lou Gehrig's life and his current life?
You know what? The only intermission period thing he ever mentioned was that choosing me to be his mom. And it seemed like from what Dr. Tucker told me, that's really similar, that kids don't have that many detailed remembrances of the intermission period.
Has he brought up any new memories since you wrote the book?
He said little things here and there, like some funny things. But at this point, it's hard for me to interpret whether it's things he might have heard, because now he watches TV. He's seen Pride of the Yankees. Like, you know, there's certain little things that couldn't have come from the movies, but it's more of a fun thing for us, I would say. And it's really, it's a special thing for us. Like, we have pictures of Lou Gehrig and his mother in our house, and it almost feels as if they're like deceased relatives who are still a part of our family, if that's a way to put it. And someone asked him, we were in a meeting one time for the movie, and the producer asked him, you know, he was pretty little. He was like 5 or 6 maybe. And the producer said, well, is Lou Gehrig still alive today? And Christian said, yeah. And then the producer said, well, where is he? And Christian said, it was so sweet. He like put his hand down his shirt, and he said, in my heart. So that kind of explains how Christian feels about it. Like, it's something very close to him that's very sacred and special. It's not something, you know, that it's not something that he's like proud of or walks around saying, I was Lou Gehrig. Like, he's very much himself, and he still plays baseball, and it's not like we're sitting there going, go Lou, you know, like, it's just something special in our lives.
And there was one thing in the book about, it was reported that Lou Gehrig, he did the speech where he was retiring from baseball. And it said that he knew that he had some kind of terminal illness at the time. But you managed to prove that that wasn't the case.
Right. The common belief, because the way that history has written it through the movies, through Pride of the Yankees, which was a movie, in, I think it was like 1952 that movie came out, maybe. I'm not sure exactly on the year. In the movie, they have him get diagnosed with this terminal illness, and then he gives this speech, I may have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for, and I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. So people always assume that when he gave that speech, he knew he was going to die. But through my regressions, I just was convinced otherwise. And I was able to, you know, later go and find proof that he was not given the information that his disease was terminal, and he really didn't know he was going to die. So that's something like baseball fans, even the most avid baseball fans, don't really know that, because that's not the way history's written the story.
And his wife did not get on with his mother, did she?
Right. It's a big source of pain for Lou Gehrig and his mother, I think, is the fact that he was married, and especially towards the end of his life when he became incapacitated, he was very much out of touch with his mother, who he had always been quite close with. So one of the things that Dr. Tucker and Ian Stevenson talk about is how a lot of times when kids come back with these memories, it's from a lifetime that was cut tragically short, generally through illness or some kind of accident. A lot of times it's males, as you may have noticed, and that there's some kind of unfinished business. So it really does make sense that perhaps Lou Gehrig and his mother needed healing and to come together in another lifetime. And one of the most beautiful things, I can't even remember if it's in the book, I think it is that when I asked my higher self, what was the purpose of Christian and me coming back together in this lifetime? The answer was, you know, for closure and to relive the good times. So to me, it's such a beautiful message that to be in this physical body is something that we choose because we long for things like eating an ice cream cone, you know, holding the hand of a loved one, swimming in the ocean, like all of these physical pleasures that when you're in spirit form, you long for. I'm sure you long for these things. Like, let's say you could see people enjoying life. So as painful as life can be, if we can appreciate the beauty and just these simple moments of these little pleasures, I really think that's one of the main purposes of life.
And in the book, you talk about Christian visiting Lou Gehrig's grave. How was that?
Yeah, you know what? That was an emotional time. And his sister was with us, too. It was the three of us. And it was very sweet how she could read. He couldn't read at the time, so she was reading the engravings there for him, and you know, he put a flower. I have a video of that too. It's really sweet. But it really, what was amazing about that trip is he was 6. I think he had just turned 6, and it provided a real closure. Like, beyond that, he kind of stopped talking about it as much. And he just kind of got on with his life. It was almost like he got to say goodbye.
So it was some kind of closure for him.
Yeah. One thing I want to say about that with James Leininger, because we've spent some time with him recently, is that he had the same thing where the memories dissipated. But now that he's like 20, a lot of it's coming back to him and he's kind of struggling with it a bit. But it's an interesting thing. So I do feel like things can kind of come and go too.
Do you feel that there's a reason that the memories have come back to Christian?
Yeah, well, Christian's still pretty much, you know, not having like, he has all the memories, but he doesn't have new spontaneous memories. Whereas I think James is actually having spontaneous memories again, like he had when he was little. And for James, you know, it was really sweet because James gave Christian a lot of advice when we met him for the first time. And James struggled because he got bullied in school over it. And he really had a hard time when he was younger. But it was cute. He said to Christian, he's like, oh, well, you probably won't get bullied because people like baseball players. And it was cute. He was looking out for Christian. And it was the first child that James had ever met that had an experience similar to their own. So it's been a really special relationship, I think, just to have them be able to relate to each other. And I really want to help them to bring their story to a movie like we're doing with ours, because I feel like that story, I mean, the details of the memories that James had are beyond mind-blowing.
And so do you get much contact from other parents who have children with these kinds of memories? And would you say this is something that happens a lot, but people just kind of sweep it under the rug and keep it quiet?
Right. I think, yeah, I do. I get a lot of inquiries from, or a lot of, you know, emails and messages on Facebook from parents, friends, even close friends whose kids continue to say things. And even things like, you know, I have friends with kids who, you know, have visitations with grandparents who have passed, and they'll say things that the kids could have never known that the grandparents told them. So I think it's all kind of in that same realm. And I really do believe that kids are closer to that veil between the ages of like 3 to 6, where they can kind of cross over more than we do as adults, where they have access to that information that we, you know, we kind of shut out as we get older, just because we are in this, you know, where we put our skin on, I would say. We're not as open.
And do you have advice for parents with children like this? If there were any parents listening to this right now, what would you say?
Yeah, I would say just to try to be as open as you can, to not let your own beliefs get in the way, just to listen. And I think the most comforting advice that I was given is that it doesn't last forever. That, you know, that you've got to just get through it and probably not to be embarrassed by it, because I think it does create like a bit of shame, like my child's different, or, you know. So I think really Christian knowing that we listened and that we believed him, I think it was very special for him. It helped him to deal with it and find closure.
And something that you touched on earlier was the fact that it wasn't a baseball household, because there are critics who may say that he was influenced because you and your husband were big baseball fans.
Right, or that we were watching the Dodgers on TV every day and he could just pick this stuff up, right? Yeah, we definitely were not baseball people. His dad's a tennis player.
And how did his father deal with all this information that was coming through?
Yeah, his father didn't have like the religious guilt that I had, because he wasn't as set in that way. But he did kind of want to just ignore it and make it go away too. And he didn't want Christian to be different. Like he's the type of person, like he didn't even teach our kids to speak German because he didn't want them to be perceived as different. Like he very much likes things to be in the norm. So I'd say in that way, it kind of threw him off a bit, but there's no denying it. And anyone that really knows Christian well and hears him talk about it, and it's just part of who he is, really.
Do you have any plans for writing another book?
Not at this point. I mean, I'd love to help other people to bring their stories. I've learned a lot through the process of selling my book rights to become a movie, and I do live in Los Angeles, so I feel like there's so many other stories like this of hope and faith that have these messages that I'd like to help them get to a bigger audience by way of a movie. So that's kind of what I'd like to do now.
Who's going to be in the movie? Has that been decided yet?
You know what? It's all still kind of up in the air, but we're getting close.
Well, that's good. I suppose you're not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, the minute I talk about it, things change. So I've learned to wait to talk about it. We were about to start shooting last fall, and they pulled the plug like 2 weeks before we were going to shoot. So I've learned in Hollywood that nothing's done until it's done.
Thanks a lot for coming on to the Past Lives podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for all that you do to keep these stories out in the world and for bringing people together in this way.
And people can get the book on Amazon and other places, can't they?
Right. It's available pretty much everywhere. The paperback just comes out this week, and there's also an audiobook.
And who's narrating the audiobook?
I did the audiobook, believe it or not.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and the publisher is Hay House.
Because that makes it a lot more kind of personal, doesn't it, when it's the actual person who wrote the book doing the narrating.
Right. It was a lot of fun doing that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Simon.
Here in part two, I'm going to be talking about a boy that remembers a past life as a pilot in World War II. Now, this information comes from a great book that I recommend on my website. It's by Dr. Jim Tucker, and it's called Return to Life. This is the James Linninger case that I was talking to Kathy about in the first half of this podcast. Now, I'm going to go into some detail here, and the reason is that there is so much that was said by the boy that has these memories, and so much of it was confirmed. But I should point out that there is a lot more detail in the book, and this is only one of the cases examined in there. So Dr. Tucker has taken over the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson that began in the 1960s at the University of Virginia. Many, many cases of children with past life memories have been studied, and the university's Division of Perceptual Studies has over 2,600 on file. This case is regarding James Linninger. When James was 4 years old, a TV show did a feature on him. The feature was not ever broadcast, but it does serve as a way to document what James was saying before his previous incarnation was identified. It also shows that what James's parents were reporting to have been said was indeed said before James was 5 years old. He first appeared to have a great interest in aircraft at the age of 22 months. His father took him to a flight museum close to Dallas, and he insisted on spending a lot of time in the World War II exhibition. When they left, his father bought him several toy planes and a video on the Blue Angels Navy flight team. This became James's favourite video, and he would watch it for hours. Over time, James would crash his toy aeroplanes into the coffee table and say, "Airplane crash on fire." Also, when James and his mother would say goodbye to his father at the airport, he would say, "Airplane crash on fire." James began having nightmares a short while after going to the museum. These nightmares would occur several nights a week. His mother would enter his room and find him kicking his legs in the air and screaming. He would say, "Airplane crash on fire. Little man can't get out." James's aunt said it was like watching someone fighting for their life. It was obviously a very emotional experience for James, and he became very upset. A few weeks later, James' mother was reading him a bedtime story, and he said, "Little man's going like this," and he kicked his legs up in the air. He then said, "Can't get out." James's mother called his father in, and I asked James what had happened to his plane. James said it had crashed on fire. His father asked him why, and James said that it had been shot. He was then asked who shot it, and James, who was getting quite flustered at all these questions, exclaimed, "The Japanese." A few nights later, James told his mum and dad that he'd been flying a plane called a Corsair. This was a plane that was developed in World War II. He also said that he had flown off a boat, and his father asked him what the boat was called. When he said the Natoma, his dad said that that sounded Japanese, but James said it was American. One day, when James was 2 years old, he was playing in the sunroom in their house. He said to his mum, "Mama, before I was born, I was a pilot, and my airplane got shot in the engine, and it crashed in the water, and that's how I died." His mum says that around that time, James said that he flew off a boat and that he was shot down by the Japanese. Around this time, James's mum bought him a toy aeroplane, and she pointed out that it had a big bomb underneath it, but James corrected her and said it was a drop tank. And this was correct. James's father started searching online for a ship called the Natoma. After some effort, on the 27th of August 2000, he found a record of an escort carrier called the USS Natoma Bay. The Natoma Bay was stationed in the Pacific in the Second World War. On that date, we know that James was only 28 months old. This is amazing that a child so young could be giving such specific information about things he couldn't possibly have known about through any normal means. Little James would always tell his parents that the man in the aeroplane was me, or James. When asked if the pilot James had anyone with him, he said there was a man called Jack, and his second name was Larson. When asked if Jack was a friend of James, he said that he was also a pilot. A few weeks after the name Jack Larson came up, James's dad bought a book called The Battle for Iwo Jima, 1945. He was looking through it with James on his lap, and when he turned a page and James pointed at a photograph and said, "That's where I was shot down." His dad said, "What?" And James said, "My airplane got shot down there, Daddy." The photograph was an aerial view of the base on the island of Iwo Jima. A few days later, James's dad found the Natoma Bay Association and called the number listed with it. He talked to a man who was stationed on the Natoma Bay during the battle at Iwo Jima. The man remembered a pilot called Jack Larson, but did not know what happened to him. One day, James's dad put a large map of the world on the table and asked him where Little Man's plane was. James put his finger on a place on the Pacific Ocean, and when his parents took a close look, it was directly on Iwo Jima. James's dad asked him where the aircraft was hit when it was shot down, and James said it was straight in the front of the propeller. When James was 4.5 years old, he went with his farmer to the Natoma Bay reunion. James's dad told people there that he was writing a book. They learned there that the pilot, Jack Larson, was still alive, and that only one pilot was killed at Iwo Jima. He was 21-year-old James Houston. The pilots from the Natoma Bay took part in a total of 175 flights during the days of the battle for Iwo Jima. Notes on the Natoma Bay Aircraft Action Report from the 3rd of March 1945 say heavy anti-aircraft fire put the planes under fire from both sides of the harbour. James Houston's plane was apparently hit by fire as he approached the harbour entrance. The other pilots did not see him get hit, but his plane suddenly started dropping at a 45-degree angle. It then crashed into the sea, exploded and burned. It quickly sank below the surface and left only a green oily mark on the water. James's dad visited Jack Larson, who remembered the battle when James Houston got shot down. He said that the anti-aircraft fire was very intense, but didn't see James Houston's plane get hit. After posting a query on the Natoma Bay Association website about the battle, James's dad got a call from a pilot who was involved but was flying from a different carrier, the USS Sergeant Bay. The caller said that he had seen a plane from the Natoma Bay take a direct hit on the nose of the aircraft, just as James had described. Eventually, James's dad talked to three other pilots who all confirmed that the plane was hit right in the middle of the engine. James also said that when his plane was hit, Jack Larson was close to him. In the action report, the trace drawing showing each aircraft's path showed Jack Larson nearby. At the time, one of the unresolved errors in James's details was that he said that he had flown an aircraft called a Corsair. The problem was that the Corsairs did not fly from the Natoma Bay. The pilots flew an aircraft called an FM-2. When James was 6, his dad made him a model FM-2. James said that the model company had missed the small aerial that was at the back of the aeroplane sticking out sideways. He said people were always accidentally walking into it. James's dad did some research and found that this was correct. James's mum asked him one day if Little Man had any family. James said that he had two sisters, Ruth and Annie. He said that Annie was 4 years older than him and that Ruth was 4 years older than Annie. These details were found to be correct for James Houston's family. James's mum and dad found Annie was still alive and both of them contacted her, and eventually she sent them photographs of James Houston. In two of the pictures, James could be seen standing in front of a Corsair. This resolved the earlier problem where James said that he flew Corsairs, but none were on the Natoma Bay. James's father later found out that before James Houston was a pilot on the Natoma Bay, he was a test pilot flying Corsairs for the Navy. Test landings needed to be made after the Corsair was modified. The problem they had with the landing was that the Corsair would always land too heavily and the tyres would burst. James had stated that the reason he had flown them in the previous life was that they always got flat tyres. James said that in his previous life, his father used to get drunk a lot and would become abusive. The family eventually put him into rehab. When he returned, James's sister Anne moved out and went to live with her grandparents. James's mother contacted Anne and she confirmed that these details were true. Anne later said of James, "This child couldn't know the things he does, he just couldn't, so I believe he is somehow part of my brother." These are things that you read about. There must be a reason for it, but I have no hint of what it could be. It's some phenomenon that I don't understand. It all happened nearly 60 years ago, and there must be a reason. James would draw many pictures of aircraft in battle, and he would always sign them James 3. When asked why, he said that he was the third James. James Houston's father was also called James, so this would make James Leninger the third James. When James was 6 and a half, he visited an Natoma Bay reunion. It was in a museum, and as they were walking past a 5-inch cannon, James said that they had one of those on the Natoma Bay. When one of the veterans asked him where on the ship, he said the fantail at the back, which was correct. A little later that day, a man came up to James and asked him, "Do you know who I am?" And James said, "You're Bob Greenwalt." James was correct. He said that he recognised his voice. One day when James was 6 years old, he was looking at a model of an FM2 and said that they used to fill the drop tanks with oil, and when they dropped them, they would explode. James's father contacted Jack Larson, and he said that they would fill the drop tanks with a mixture of napalm and gasoline. A hand grenade would be attached, and when the drop tank was released, a cable would pull out the pin. Now, James would talk a little bit about the intermission period between his previous life and his current life. When he was small, he would receive G.I. Joes as presents. Eventually, he had three of them. He named them Walter, Leon, and Billy. And when asked how he chose those names, he said these were the friends that met him when he got to heaven. Of the men on the Natoma Bay that were killed before James, there was a Walter Devlin, a Leon Connor, and a Billy Peeler. The day after this, James's mum asked him if there really was a heaven, and he said yes. She asked him where it was, and he spread his arms out and said, "It's right here." He said it was the most beautiful place in the world. She thanked him, and then she asked him if there was really a God, and he said yes. And she said, "Is God a man or a woman?" And he replied that God is whoever you need him to be at the time. She asked him if everyone comes back to Earth, and he said, "You can come back if you want to. If you don't want to, you don't have to." When James was about 4 and a half, he told his dad how glad he was that he chose him to be his father. He said he knew he would be a good dad, and that when he found his mum and dad, he knew they would be good to him. His dad asked him where he found them, and he said Hawaii. He said he found them when they were staying at a big pink hotel, and that he saw them on the beach eating dinner. James's parents had been to Hawaii before he was born. They stayed at a hotel that was indeed painted pink. This was the first week that they had decided to start trying for a baby, and they had finished their holiday with a dinner on the beach. Dr. Tucker writes in his book, "All in all, this is a quite remarkable case. I have trouble coming up with an ordinary explanation for it." Dr. Tucker met James when he was 12 years old and said that the memories had all but gone. He states that this is normal for a child with this kind of experience. So that was a great interview with Kathy Bird, and her book is called The Boy Who Knew Too Much. Don't forget, if you would like to support the podcast, you can do so through Patreon. Please visit the homepage of my website, www.pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and click on the Become a Patreon button. If you're enjoying the podcast, why not leave a review? Also, I'm on Instagram and Twitter. If you want to find me, the Twitter name is @SimonGBown. You can message me there or on Facebook, where you'll be very welcome to join the Past Lives Podcast Facebook group. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. Thanks for listening.